Welcome to The Jewish Diasporist, a podcast exploring the political, social, and cultural implications of life in diaspora. We are two of your hosts, Zach Smerin
and Ben Yanowitz. On October 1st, Claudia Sheinbaum became the first woman and first Jew to be seated as Mexico's president. This represents a significant moment in Mexico's history as she continues the quote-unquote fourth transformation that was begun by President López Obrador and his Morena party.
But what is the history of Mexico's Jewish left? How is it that a country with a conservative and Catholic reputation and with a relatively small Jewish population has elected a Jewish woman to the country's highest office well before the United States?
To help us answer this question and others, we have invited on Tamara Gleason Friedberg, a Mexican historian and Yiddishist who focuses on the Mexican Yiddish press during the Holocaust. She has also written one of the only detailed works on the history of the Bund in Mexico.
In our discussion, we outlined the long history of Jews in the land today called Mexico, from the first Jews who came fleeing the Spanish Inquisition to those who came as part of the mass migration from Eastern Europe.
In particular, we focused on the last century and a half to explore how Jews have taken part in the tumult of Mexico's left from the revolution at the dawn of the 20th century through decades of one-party rule up to today.
While this remains a Jewish-focused conversation, we talked in detail about general issues faced across the region. It's important for Jewish diasporists and socialists to not be pigeonholed into simply discussing quote-unquote Jewish issues.
We recorded this conversation in two parts just before Sheinbaum took office. La Presidenta faces a number of challenges which can only be tackled on a transnational basis. From the struggle against the cartels, who have been fueled by American guns and the U.S. drug market, to the ecological crisis and relations with the new and old left across the region. President Sheinbaum's ability to accomplish her goals are bound to what will happen in the U.S. election this upcoming week. May fascism and its imperialism be defeated everywhere.
Shout out to Ben's roommate cat/daughter, Baby Pants, who can be heard at some points in this video.
We do love Baby Pants. And thank you to all of our donors, supporters, and audience. If you like what we are doing here, please rate our show on your podcast platform of choice. Follow us on Instagram at The Jewish Diasporist Pod, and consider becoming a donor on Patreon. Most importantly, please share our content with our communities. It's how we reach as many people as possible. Every donation, like, follow, and share helps us build the world that we want to be living in.
With a further ado, let's get into it.
So I'm originally from Mexico. I was born in Mexico, and the past 9 years I have been living in the UK, where I have done several things in the Yiddish scene. I'm very active with Yiddish. It's a very important part of my identity. I have done stuff like the Yiddish Open Mic, Yiddish House London, and I'm pursuing a PhD in the Department of Hebrew and Jewish Studies at UCL. And my research is about how the news about the Holocaust affected the Jewish community in Mexico during the war period.
We've already had a few episodes, or even parts of episodes, if you look at the work that I did with Summer U, about particular Jewish communities in places that we don't know too much about. And this is the first time that we're really looking at Mexico. Could you tell us a little bit about the history of the Jewish community in Mexico, just in the very basic ideas? I believe that some of the first Jews that ended up in Mexico were conversos, or people that somehow managed to find themselves there after the Spanish Inquisition and colonization.
Yes, definitely. I must say I'm not an expert on the first immigration of Jews to Mexico, but definitely they arrived, like even with Columbus, one of the people in his expedition who had an important role, he was Jewish, Luis de Torres, right? Since then, there has been Jewish presence in the Americas for sure. And a lot of conversos migrated into the Americas and of course to the territory of Mexico. And we even have the case of a couple of them who were still several years after following their Jewish faith in a covert way, and they were prosecuted and sentenced to death by the Inquisition. And we definitely have that happening. Hundreds of Jews fleeing to the Americas, searching for new opportunities. So that's definitely something to take into account. And there are a couple of communities in Mexico that claim to have this link to these conversos, to be like descendants of the conversos. And also it's interesting because this is something that Ashkenazi Jews later across the Americas, and not only in Mexico will use to portray the Americas as a place of refuge for Jews in general, and to understand their place in the Americas as not only something that was just like coincidental or that happened very recently. So they will try to build this longer history of Jewish presence in the Americas to create like deeper roots to the territory. So that's something interesting to take into account. There are some research works about conversos in Mexico. Recently, there has been an excavation into what was a mikveh in a town near Puebla, and that's really interesting.
Yeah, no, I was actually reading about that yesterday and just doing some preparation for this conversation. It sounded like there was like the first mikveh in the Americas was there in, I think it was in northern Mexico somewhere, and then also there was like the first synagogues, which are actually basically people meeting in their homes. But yeah, it's very interesting to look at that longer history and see that, yeah, there were some of the first Jews in the Americas were in Mexico. But then you're talking from your own experience about Yiddish and Ashkenazi immigration and culture. So I was kind of wondering if we could talk about those waves of immigration that came following the conversos. I know there were some that came from Syria, different Sephardic waves, and then eventually you do have Ashkenazi immigrants coming in the, I believe, 1880s alongside many Ashkenazi migrations to elsewhere as well. Could you say a little bit about that and your family's history in that broader wave of immigration, perhaps?
Yes, definitely. Just to finish with the topic of the conversos and the crypto Jews and Columbus, there was a very important Yiddish epic poem called Columbus, and you can check it out online, and it's in Yiddish, and it's telling the story of Luis de Torres precisely. So we do see a lot of like creative work happening around this topic in Yiddish, and I think that's really interesting. Now, regarding Jewish immigration to Mexico, we have a couple, like a few immigrants who were mainly like businessmen in Mexico City, but they didn't have a Jewish community per se. And then you have a little bit before the Mexican Revolution, a couple of other Jewish immigrants start arriving, and you really start seeing more Jewish immigration after the Mexican Revolution. And you will have like a wave of Syrian Jews, later on also Sephardim. And I will say that most of the Jews who are Ashkenazim, who were Ashkenazim, migrated into Mexico in 1920s. Some of them wanted to go to the United States, but as you might know, the United States established a quota system in 1924, which was made in purpose to curtail Jewish immigration into the United States. So a lot of the Jews who wanted to go to the United States thought that it was a good idea to first go to Mexico and then try to like illegally migrate to the United States or something like that. But then they ended up staying in Mexico. They managed to make a living there and so on. And then you have also like net migration of people who know already people who are in Mexico and they were doing more or less well and they will travel there, or family members. So yeah. And I will say that in 1934, unfortunately, Mexico established also a quota system. And one of the groups that was pointed out as non-desirable were Jews. So Jews, Roma people, and Asians were not desirable. So they tried to limit Jewish immigration into the country. And the excuse they used at that point was the idea that Mexico was a country of mestizos, that meaning the mix between the Spanish and the indigenous groups and so on, and that Jews will not be able to assimilate well. So you have this very interesting thing in the post-revolutionary Mexico, very more left-wing government, but the policing of immigration was rather anti-Semitic, although this government itself was fighting very much the right, which was outwardly anti-Semitic, right? So that's something interesting to take into account. We're talking as well of the presidency of Lázaro Cárdenas, who was very progressive in a lot of realms. So that's something to take into account.
I thought it was interesting saying that some Jews would come to Mexico and then go north, because that's a very common avenue of migration currently.
Yeah.
So it's sort of interesting to be able to situate Jews within that and recognize that actually we've been there. And that definitely gives us a, not that we need a reason to put our hearts and think about those that are migrating northbound through Mexico these days, because they are going through a lot of oppression and difficulties every single day. But it's interesting to be able to situate Jews within that and recognize that we've been there as well.
Definitely.
Something to connect as well with the situation right now in the United States is this whole thing that's been going on about Springfield, Ohio, is basically just a watered down version of blood libel. So there's always parallels that can be found. I've been quite interested with the presidency of Lázaro Cárdenas, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, specifically that he does in some ways manage to maintain quite a progressive government, in an area that is often summarized as being America's backyard when it comes to, for example, nationalizing oil, which in many other places was considered often a source of foreign meddling, also supporting the Spanish Republic?
Yeah, so definitely. I think that's going to be a very interesting point because you do have all these Yiddish-speaking leftist anti-fascist activists who are going to really be part of these broader anti-fascist movements, and they will be working together. So definitely Lázaro Cárdenas was one of the two regimes that actually really supported the Republicanos during the Spanish Civil War by sending them even arms, right? You're going to find that Mexicans went to fight in the Spanish Civil War. There were like working together, these Yiddish anti-fascists with the Mexican anti-fascists and with some Spanish Republicanos who travel Mexico trying to fundraise money. And then what you are going to have is that despite the fact that we know very well that Lázaro Cárdenas did not open the doors for Jews and actually had a very restrictive policy towards Jews, it was one of the safe havens for the Spanish Republicanos. It received thousands of them, and they really became part of the intellectual community in Mexico. That was one of the main places where they found a safe haven. So that's something interesting to take into account. And we have Yiddish poetry in Mexico about the Spanish Civil War and about the role that Jews in one way or the other play in the Spanish Civil War. There's a book called Fallen in Blood by Jankev Glantz talking about the Spanish Civil War and about those Jews who went to fight in international brigades. So these Jews were aware that Jews were not welcome into Mexico, but they were also very aware that this was a very progressive government and that they were disarticulating the Mexican right, which was very, very anti-Semitic. So yeah, that's something definitely to take into account. They very much admired the president, these Jewish socialists. They worked together during the war period. During the war period, the Mexican left became a very important supporter of Jews, not in the terms of receiving immigrants, because we know that they also did not receive refugees and there was a whole ship that was sent back, but definitely in trying to mobilize the public opinion so Mexico would become part of the Allied effort. So that's also something to take into account. And anti-fascist Jews in Mexico found a forum within the Mexican left to talk about what was happening. So for example, in 1942, in December, when finally the news about the plan to exterminate all of European Jewry were confirmed by the US State Department, the Jewish Labor Committee in the United States organized a strike. And then the Bundists in Mexico, who had contact with the Jewish Labor Committee, were very much in contact, convinced Mexican labor leader Vicente Lombardo Toledano to organize a strike as well. So we have in December 1942, a workers' strike to protest the massive killing of Jews by the Nazis. And Vicente Lombardo Toledano, who was a very important labor leader, also kind of like the president of transnational labor movement in Latin America called the CETAL, he organized a transnational strike in 1942. So you have also other countries joining in.
Before we get to that, I also wanted to mention, just on a personal note, one of the earliest indications of some sort of Jewish presence in Mexico that I personally came across was that one of my good friends in school was someone whose grandmother arrived from Poland to Mexico in 1935. Over 70 years later, that grandmother allowed his family to get Polish passport and repatriate, to immigrate to Poland. I understand that immigration was massively restricted after 1934, but still, there were some possibilities.
Yes, I mean, it was restricted. It was kind of like these groups are non-desirable, which did affect people who would get a visa and so on. But that doesn't mean that people do not find a way around it, right? And of course, even if it was restricted, if you had family members already in Mexico, you would be able to get a visa. If you had a specific job, you were able to get a visa. My great-great-grandfather migrated a little bit earlier, but my great-grandmother, like his daughter, migrated into Mexico in 1936 from Warsaw. So yeah, and of course, you have several, like a couple of hundreds who managed to arrive to Mexico after 1934. But the law really tried to curtail that immigration. And you'll find that the same happens with the United States, right? Like people find certain ways, but in general, it affects how many people can get in and so on.
I did read about there was like at least one ship of like 200 almost all Jews who came from Cuba, of course, using that as like a halfway point. And that actually included, I believe, was it the great grandfather of the incoming president, Claudia Sheinbaum, who was a communist Jew who then was part of the Cuban Communist Party and then came into Mexico and moved into Mexico City and became very active within the Communist Party there. I was wondering if you could say a little bit about the different formations across the Mexican left and then where Jews fit in within the broader constellation of different left-wing movements within Mexico in the 30s, especially, but also just in that broad time period.
Yes, sure. Can I just like, you mentioned something like how many people did you say arrived in the boat?
I believe that was 200.
Yeah, but not all of them were Jews, right?
No, not all of them. A lot of them though were Jewish that then like hid their names. That's what Claudia Sheinbaum's family did. They changed their names on the documents and used that as a way to pass over across the border.
Yeah, there is some research about like the ships and how many were Jews and so on. And of course they were coming. Like, I'm not saying they were not coming. I'm just pointing out that the law, unfortunately, pointed out that they were non-desirable and that definitely affected how many people could migrate into Mexico. So yeah, it's very interesting. The Communist Party in Mexico was forbidden for several years. And then I think, if I'm not mistaken, with the presidency of Lázaro Cárdenas, it became again legal, right? And you do have several Jews that were part of the Communist Party. They were also part of the different groups that constantly changed name that were the Yiddish communist organizations, right? At some point you have Gezbir, which is Gesellschaft Birobidzhan, being this project of creating these kind of like autonomous states as part of the Soviet Union where Yiddish was the main language, right? So you have Gesellschaft Birobidzhan, and then you have like La Liga Popular Israelita and so on. So you definitely have a communist group. You also have a Bundis group. Originally these two groups were together because you have very few people and then they start to evolve and change and so on. And they were together in an organization called Kulturzentrum, which was like a cultural center or something like that. Later on, they of course had their own conflicts and they divided. So you have the group that is kind of like more inclined to Bundism. Right? And it's during the 40s that these groups get more solidified and so on. You also have very important anarchist, Jack Abrams, who actually was in the United States before, and he was expelled. He went to the Soviet Union, got very disenchanted about the Soviet Union since the anarchists were persecuted there, and ended up in Mexico. And he was very, very active. He was one of the important activists of the non-Zionist Yiddish newspaper in Mexico, and very much active in Mexican anti-fascist spaces that were not communist, right? And then you also have a couple of social Zionists who are also doing things. And you have very interesting characters that do not fit into one of these groups. So they move kind of around. Yankov Glantz, for example, whom I have mentioned, I think he's one of the most interesting characters in the Mexican Jewish community at the time because he was very active in the anti-fascist Mexican scene. He was part of the Liga de Escritores y Artistas Revolucionarios, which was the League of Revolutionary Artists and Writers. They were creating art together and he was working together with Mexican leftist artists. They were doing things together. I think that's very important to take into account. Usually the historiography focuses more on what the German Jewish exiles were able to do in Mexico because they were very, very famous. They came during the war period and oftentimes this historiography downplays whatever the Yiddish-speaking Jews were doing and say that, okay, that wasn't relevant. But I think it's very important to, for example, take into account that after Kristallnacht, the Gezbir communist organization, a Yiddish organization I was talking about, together with Mexican anti-fascists and with this anarchist I was talking about, they organized like a meeting talking about what was happening in Germany, trying to mobilize the public opinion and so on. So you do have a lot of people working together in Mexico and finding a place within the Mexican left to not only activate politically, but also kind of like integrate into Mexico, more generally speaking. So yeah, you do have very diverse groups. As you know, during the war period, some of them got into very big fights and divide, especially after Ehrlich and Viktor Alter, very important Bundist leaders, were killed in the Soviet Union. And after that, you have no more collaboration between the Bundists and the communists. But before that, because of the Popular Front, you have a lot of people like working together and doing very interesting things together.
I want to ask about the Bund right now, but there's just one thing that came to mind beforehand. At this time in Mexico, you have Lev Trotsky. And I'm wondering, because I made a joke at Trotskyist expense in episode 39, perhaps I could repair my standing with them to ask, is there any sort of active movement in the Jewish community? After all, Trotsky is a Jewish socialist, one might say, that is present, if anywhere, then it would be in perhaps Mexico.
That's interesting, because of course Bundist or anarchists did not love Trotsky, right? For very specific reasons. But well, if we think about how Trotsky was able to get a visa to Mexico, and let's just remember that nobody wanted to take in Trotsky. They tried everywhere. They tried to get him a visa absolutely everywhere. And I think like Sweden said like only for a year and then you have to move. Mexico, they gave a visa. And I think that's a very clear example of how President Lázaro Cárdenas was not like a communist, right? He gave a visa to one of the most hated characters in the history of communism, perhaps in the Stalinist era. Actually, some of the people who were working for Trotsky to be able to get a visa were Yiddish writers. So you have Yiddish writers and intellectuals and people who were not actively writing Yiddish, probably they knew Yiddish. So you have someone like Anita Brenner, who is a very interesting character, a Jew from the United States who migrated very young to Mexico. And then she played a very interesting role in talking about Mexican popular culture, Mexican popular art, bringing this art to the Mexican scene in general as something that should be appreciated. And then you have someone like Berliner, who is a Yiddish poet, also signing these letters to let Trotsky in. And you have, of course, Diego Rivera, right? This very important muralist supporting the process to give Trotsky a visa. So there are definitely some connections. And later on, when Trotsky is in Mexico, and well, he's not there for very long because he gets killed by communists, right, in Mexico. You do have a couple of interviews that one of the Yiddish journalists published in the Mandate of Palestine, actually, in Yiddish, right? So you do have these connections. They met a couple of times and so on, but I wouldn't say that they were very close.
Now that we've mentioned Trotsky in, well, not two episodes in a row, but we mentioned him recently, it's time not to mention him for the next 40 episodes. sorry to our listeners who will be disappointed by this decision, but as we have made it at a democratic centralist level, there's nothing you can do about it. So anyway...
I'd also like to add, I read this article, I will probably put the link into the description because it's a Jacobin article called Claudia Sheinbaum's Radical Jewish Heritage that I read last night. And in it, it talks about her grandfather named Chon Sheinbaum, who was in 1939 brought on as part of the Central Committee of the Mexican Communist Party. But then the following year, basically because of, I believe it was his brother that was in the Soviet Union that was labeled a Trotskyist in 1936. And then the Soviet Union was like, oh, you are probably a Trotskyist spy. And they purged him from the party in 1940. That's Claudia Sheinbaum's grandfather. And he was brought back in after a vigorous self-criticism back into the party in 1954 at the same time when he was brought alongside Diego Rivera, who was also purged from the party in that ensuing period at the height of Stalinist...
People's justice.
And well, it's interesting because Sheinbaum, that surname, and I think it's the same family, I have seen it in the Yiddish communist newspapers that they are sending greetings. I wouldn't say they were the most active in the Yiddish communist group, but they were definitely there, and they were definitely part of the communist group in Mexico for sure.
Also, I was going to say Stalinist paranoia. That's the word I was thinking of, but my brain is still waking up.
One man's terrorist, etc. We will get to Sheinbaum, but now I do want to ask about the Bund, because Tamara, you are the author of the book, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Die Schwue, los Bundistas en México y su participación en la comunidad judía, which makes you probably one of the best people to speak about the Bund in Mexico. I've been able to just sort of look at some parts of it. My Spanish is not very good. What interests me in particular is two things. The first one is this question about the Bundist treatment of peripheral organizations as opposed to where the main struggle was, in their view, taking place in Eastern European Yiddish land, whether the Russian Empire or Poland, whether they treated organizations that were outside of that as peripheral, or whether they were able to adapt themselves to local conditions and generate more of a spirit of Deutschkeit And you find in many places, whether it's Britain or South Africa or Australia or the United States or Switzerland, that this question often leans into the perspective that the real struggle is taking place in the old country. So that's question number one. The second question is that specifically in the title of your work, you talk about the participation in the Jewish community, which is a whole area of discussion in the tradition of Bundist writing. What should the engagement with the general Jewish life be, and specifically mainstream communal institutions, non-socialist institutions, and the organizations that claim to represent the Jewish community, specifically the Kehillah? And I see that you've looked into, for example, the writings of Medem or Beinish Mikhailovich, but that's something that interests me in particular. So would you be interested in speaking a bit about these two things in particular?
Yeah, definitely. I have forgotten a little bit of my research already, but for sure. Yes. So initially the Bundist in Mexico said, and I think they maintained that over time, that outside of Eastern Europe, when they themselves are no longer workers, because we have to take into account that Jews in Mexico started as peddlers and then they opened their own like small businesses, and then they were having their own workshops and selling their own stuff like they were producing, or they even became like factory owners, right? So for them, it is a big problem that they are no longer workers and they don't have the connections to the workers' movement, and that there aren't any Jewish workers in Mexico. So they do say like, okay, we cannot longer have like a Bundist party or a Bundist group here. We support the Bund and we support what is happening, but we are very much aware that the conditions are very, very different and that the situation is very different. So we're kind of like supporters of the Bund, and they will say that. And of course, they will talk about Doikai and the importance of activating in the Jewish community in Mexico. They would talk about the support that they can give to Eastern Europe and to what's happening there. But they do say in several publications that they cannot call themselves Bundist activists. Like it's interesting because at some point they have like the Bundist group, right? So that's definitely something to take into account. They are very much aware that the conditions in which they are very different, and that the Bund part of like how it was formed and the purpose for it to be founded was to support the Jewish workers and the workers class. And then they want to continue supporting that. So that's very important. And they want to continue with the values of the Bund, right? So that's going to be very, very important. They do criticize a lot of the Zionists at some point, but they also need to work together with them. It's not like in other communities that are bigger. They have to collaborate with everyone, right? So when they become part of those who were organizing the Kehile, they thought like it's very important that we all work together regardless of our ideology, and we can try to continue promoting our ideology in certain avenues, but that doesn't mean that we cannot work together. Together, right? So that's why they participate actively in the Jewish community. We're going to see that one realm in which they're really dedicated is to Yiddish schooling. And because Mexico had 3 Jewish schools that taught Yiddish on a daily basis, you can clearly see that that was one of the important values of the community. Yiddish language as one of the most important identifiers of secular Jews. So you do have that. And that's something very important. Bundists are going to have like an important position when it has to do with the cultural department and with other stuff. What I would say about the Bund during the war period is that it's complicated because the Jewish Labor Committee was central to help the Bund in Europe during the occupation. They sent a lot of money to the underground movement. For example, Warsaw Ghetto Uprising would not have happened in the same way if they didn't have the funding of the Jewish Labor Committee and of organizations which were Zionist that were supporting the underground movement. But Bundists in Mexico, together with anarchists and with others who did not define themselves as Zionist, founded a group that was the representation of the Jewish Labor Committee. And that was called Gesellschaft für Kultur und Hilfe, the Society for Aid and Culture. And they fundraised money and they tried to bring refugees to Mexico, and they managed to bring a couple of them. Something that it's important to take about the work they were doing is that the refugees they brought into Mexico were not only Jewish, it was other socialists who were not communists. were stranded in Marseille. So they played an important role in being able to facilitate the visas for these refugees. They also played an important role in spreading the news about the Holocaust. So the Bundis were the ones that convinced Vicente Lombardo Toledano of organizing the strike I talked about. Bundis were speaking about what was happening to Jews in Eastern Europe during the war in anti-fascist forums. And we have one of the first mentions of massive killings, for example, in June 1942, even before the Polish government in exile was actually acknowledging what was happening to Jews for being Jews. So that's something that's interesting to take into account. Now, after 1943, after Viktor Adler and Heinrich Herrlich were killed, and they organized memorial events together with other non-communist socialists and anarchists, they were attacked by the communists in Mexico. And after that, they were not as active politically outside of the community, as a lot of the Mexican left was very much communist. There were some spaces in which they were active, but these spaces were small. They were nevertheless contributing in these small journals in Spanish and so on.
So thank you so much for that. It's quite difficult to get information about some of these communities, particularly the similarity that perhaps is overgeneralizing, but also about the history of the Bund in Argentina, Bundists in Argentina. There's a book by Israel Laubstein, which talks about it a little bit, but with a non-Spanish speaker, you get a very surface level understanding of it, even if you do. This question about Jews migrating and not being workers or not becoming workers, I'm very skeptical in general from the perspective of today. I understand that there are obviously differences and that the Jewish economic profile between Mexico or Argentina or America, it would not have been the same as in Poland. But the thing is that when it comes to the sort of perspective of Jews not being in a demographic state to accommodate for working class organizing or for the identification of Jews as workers, was a criticism that was given to Jews in the Pale of Settlement and in Poland, specifically the perspective of Poalei Tzion and Socialist Zionists there as well. They said that the economic structure of Jews is unnatural to be able to facilitate that in that way. And you could get into more like arguments about even if you're not in a traditional industrial working class, you nevertheless still suffer alienation, you still benefit from collective bargaining, and you still benefit from a Jewish working class identity. And that transcends time and locality. You don't have to be in a predominantly Jewish workplace to be a Jewish worker. For more on this, we've discussed this in episode 21, I believe. We just released a short on our YouTube that looks into it. I recommend people look into that a bit more. The thing about size is interesting as well, because similar development takes place in Poland after the Second World War, that Bundists do reorganize the Bund in Poland. Of course, they have to stay very silent or choose to ignore the question about Alter and Ehrlich, these two Bundist leaders that were executed on Stalin's orders. They slowly get subsumed as Poland becomes a true one-party state and dictatorship. This question about not being large enough or not being influential enough to have an impact on the general politics of the country being a justification for engaging in political discussion within the Jewish community. I think this is something that is also very relevant to our conditions today, specifically when it comes to, you know, still having that presence and working on the democratization of Jewish communal institutions, going against this idea that all Jews have the same interests, that Jewish communal institutions are sort of apolitical spaces. So that's just why I wanted to comment on that.
Yeah. Like, I think what they said is like our realm of action is very limited. What I will say is like, of course, they consider themselves, after all, socialist. They consider themselves Bundists. That's exactly why they thought that their best ally will always be the left, will always be like the workers' union. And that's why they felt like they should seek the support of the workers' unions when it came to spreading the news about the Holocaust and so on, right? But I also imagine if you were like a Jew from Warsaw, from around Novolipie Street, and who was very active in different unions and with Jewish workers, and your daughter went to the Bundist school and so on, and then you move to Mexico and you're very removed from all of that. So there is this sense of, well, definitely this is not the same. We cannot participate in the same way. Most of them do not end up as workers. Some of them were in kind of like sweatshops, or they found their own sweatshops and they were doing their own work independently. And so, yeah, the situation was very much different, and they themselves are writing this, right? But yes, that's a very interesting point. And going back to how the Bund reforms in Eastern Europe. I think like the Bundists in Mexico, of course, believed that Jewish life will flourish again in Eastern Europe. They were very much against the establishment of the state of Israel in 1948. They wrote about it. They had like massive discussions with other members of the community and fights. And one of the things that they tried to kind of avoid was this idea that the Jewish community should publicly be very Zionistic and so on. So they tried to, in some way, say like, okay, there is a plurality happening here and we think differently.
We've spoken a little bit about the 1930s, as that is an era that a lot of interesting Jewish left organizing took place. But we want to move a little bit forward, and specifically the PRI, party that governed Mexico from 1928 to 2000, continued and changed in many ways, as did the Jewish community in Mexico and elsewhere. Do you think that there's anything that can be said, Tamara, about the attitude of the Jewish left to the PRI throughout its existence in the decades after the Second World War? Or is it less of a united perspective than might be expected?
I will say that it's definitely less than a united perspective. The Jewish left that actually was critical of the government would not align with typical groups that we see, although it's quite difficult because the PRI, the Partido Revolucionario Institucional, which is a party that comes from the Partido Revolucionario Mexicano, founded by Lázaro Cárdenas and so on, it's kind of a continuation and there is really not much of an opposition. So I will say during the 40s, most of the different political battles would happen within the party of who will actually be in charge of what was happening. And the problem is that the opposition that existed at that point was mainly right-wing, Catholic, and very anti-Semitic. So during the 40s, you have, of course, a lot of like these different groups from the Jewish left align themselves with the main party because they see the right as a danger. And they, of course, it is. Like, it's quite anti-Semitic, right? So one of the main opposition parties is going to be very Catholic and very anti-Semitic, as I'm saying. The Jewish community as such will be very... We have this term in Spanish, which is oficialista. They would go with whatever the official party is saying. They are not going to be criticizing that much. But then it's up to the next generation to be a little bit more critical, right? So whereas like the main Jewish community, the institutions would always align themselves with whatever government was in turn supporting it, you do see certain other more like youth groups and so on that, for example, took part in 68 of the students' movement, right? And that were critical and so on. So you definitely do see that. Unfortunately, you don't have much of the Bund left, like it doesn't carry to the next generation. You do have a Bundist youth group, but it's not that successful. What you do have more is left Zionists who are a little bit more critical of the institutional life of the community and of what is going on in Mexico. So you do have that. And I will say that nowadays, those that are a little bit more critical are still young or middle-aged people who went to a left Zionist movement like Hashom and Hatzair and who are actually very critical of Israel. So that's what I will say you can find nowadays in Mexican political life. And that's like, yeah, the next generation, not the generation of the immigrants.
That sort of, as you said, the oficialista perspective. In that same time, you also have Jews in Poland being in a very similar position. This is the period that I studied for my master's thesis, that on one hand tries to be close on good terms with the communist government because the anti-communist opposition is quite anti-Semitic, at least a significant part of it in Poland. But on the other hand, you see increasing Stalinization in Poland and the impossibility of Jewish autonomy of any kind, the dissolution of the Bund as such. The thing about Hashomer Hatzair that also reminded me of Hashomer Hatzair in South Africa, which was, I think, one of the last allowed left-wing organizations that was dissolved in 1970 under the apartheid regime. The things about Hashomer Hatzair and its policies towards Israel is that it very much depends on which national group you're talking. The situation that we've seen is, for example, Hashomer Hatzair Canada is very different towards Hashomer Hatzair in Austria, for example. Also, this question about with the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948 this surely becomes a factor of Jewish identity within the community in Mexico, no?
Yeah, I will say that by then, before 1948, like I will say 1947, 1945, a lot of the Jews in the community were already very much Zionist. What you do have is that, at least in Mexico, and I think that's a very interesting argument, is that you don't have this idea that Zionism in Mexico kind of like make Yiddish disappear. Like, I know like the policies in the state of Israel against Yiddish were very harsh, right? And were terrible. But you do have these Zionists in Mexico who are very, very Yiddishist, who are actually quite critical of the idea of that Hebrew should be the only language and so on. And you have some schools that are quite Zionist in a sense that were teaching Yiddish till the 2000s. So you do have that. There were three schools that were teaching Yiddish until the 2000s and almost on a daily basis. And one was really non-Zionist. It wasn't anti-Zionist. It was just non-Zionist. Another one was Zionist, but in this way of understanding that Zionism doesn't have to be the only way of identifying as a Jew. And the other was Zionist religious slash also Yiddishist. So you do have that in Mexico. And I think that's really, really interesting. And you do have a very typical Talmud Zionist school with the idea that Hebrew is the most important. Although the first years, they were also teaching Yiddish. When they separated, they were also teaching Yiddish because they could not teach Yiddish at the beginning. So that's something interesting. I think there is some more research to be done about Jews that are left and how they are working separately, like totally isolated from the community. Specifically, I'm thinking about like the 60s, the 80s, and I'm pretty sure Michael Rom, colleague of mine, he has done a lot of research about Jews working with very leftist organizations in Brazil. He has been able to spot quite a lot of very interesting characters. And I just wonder if that will be the case. Like, I don't know what is the case exactly for Mexico, right? I think Mexico is a very interesting place. The Cuban Revolution is planned in Mexico, right? And I just wonder, like, what? Yeah, I don't know. But of course, all these groups that were before that were very active within the Mexican left, kind of at that point are part of already more like supporting the PRI. And yeah, so I think that's something to take into account.
Yeah, sounds like there's definitely some more research that needs to be done about those periods. I'm sure there's things that could be uncovered about the ways that Jews organized autonomously, as also within the wider Mexican left. I'm sure there's a lot of stuff that could be dredged up and uncovered.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I think that more research definitely would help. Like, I just don't have the names of those activists who were Jewish and leftist and so on, right? So that's definitely missing.
Yeah, definitely. And I was wondering, because I want to take us up to the current moment where we've seen Claudia Sheinbaum elected as the first woman and the first Jewish president in Mexico, and that's certainly historic. But before we get there, I was wondering if you could say a little bit about the legacy of the Bund in Mexico, because I know that's where your expertise lies. As far as I'm aware, there's not a Bund in Mexico anymore, but there was. I was wondering if you could say a little bit about its eventual dissolution, as well as its ongoing legacy, at least as you see it.
My research is mainly about the Bund during the war period and a couple of years afterwards. But what I was able to see that also has already been kind of mentioned by historian Coladina Simet on her book on the institutionalization of the Jewish community in Mexico, is that the Bund decided at some point after 1948, after establishment of the State of Israel, that the main places in which they could do something was in the cultural department. So they were very active in the cultural department. They were trying to keep certain sessions in Yiddish. They were part of founding the Kehile. They were for that. They were active in the school system. So that's where they were mainly active. So there was an incipient youth Bund, but that wasn't that successful. And at the end, these children of Bundis ended up doing their own lives, their own things, and not being that active. The Bund in Mexico initially was very, very critical of the establishment of the State of Israel. They published certain things. They got into big arguments with most of their members of the community who supported the foundation of the State of Israel. And later on, I will say, like, by the end of the 50s, some of them were not Zionist per se, but were less critical. so to say. And kind of like there were other Bundists that made their way to Israel that accepted them. So they even traveled to Israel and wrote a little bit about their experience and so on. So they maintained contact with someone like Yitzhok Luden, who was in Tel Aviv, well, near Tel Aviv. I will say that most of the work they did was related to the cultural department to keep Yiddish, to keep Yiddishkeit, like secular Judaism, going. And I will say also printing about what was the Bund, what was lost. So you have a lot of them collaborating for the Lehrer-Yiskor-Buch, the memorial book for all the teachers, not all the teachers, but a lot of the teachers were part of the Sisho, the central school system, who were killed during the Holocaust. So you do have a lot of like work in that sense.
So just to take it back up to today, as we're seeing Claudia Sheinbaum being inaugurated, and as someone who's both Jewish and on the left, how do you understand her relationship to Jewishness? And how do you understand the significance of this moment within Mexican history?
Well, I think it's really interesting because she doesn't identify herself as Jewish. She says, I have Jewish heritage and I'm proud of my Jewish heritage. But she doesn't say, I am Jewish, right? And throughout her campaign, she has done a couple of things that are problematic in certain ways, right? So for example, at some point, I think she was wearing a cross or not, and she was wearing the symbol of the Virgin of Guadalupe, which is a very Mexican symbol, if you want to see it like that. So you definitely have certain things that she was doing in order to pass as a Mexican in a very stereotypical way, so to say, right? You do have a lot of like the anti-Semitic campaigns, both within the left and coming from the right, of course, talks a lot about her being Jewish foreigner, saying like, oh, her mother wasn't even born in Mexico, that's invented or something like that. Also talking about her communist past, but actually kind of like anti-Semitic tropes of like communist and Jews are the same.
Like classical Judeo-communist idea.
Yeah, and it is true that her grandparents were communists. Like they were. Like I see them in the Yiddish journals. I have read up from the communists. They were part of it. But of course, they are kind of using this kind of startup. So I think it's a big, massive thing that she won. The competition was with another woman. And it's the first time that there's a woman who is a president from Mexico. So that's great. Before Canada or the United States.
Right. You've mentioned that anti-Semitism has manifested on the left as well. How has that appeared?
So for example, there is one person who is very, very anti-Semitic within the left, who is called Jalife, and he has a lot of followers, unfortunately. One of the things that he has been saying all along is that he was part of the same party as Claudia Sheinbaum, but he represents another type of that left completely. And he has been quite ostracized by the party itself because, yeah. So he basically says that Claudia Sheinbaum is like an ally of Soros, and you know, the typical Soros, I don't know, like conspiration theories. So he definitely is very much into that.
I'm just looking up, this is Alfredo Jalife Ram, and it does say on his Wikipedia page, it says, he is critical of the Anglo-Saxon military, industrial, and oil complex, as well as Zionism in general, and its financial aspect in particular. Which I think is a very interesting thing to say, because leftists are going to be critical of these things, but there's this really long-term history that goes back to the turn of the 20th century, where, like, I found during the Boer War, which was, like, at the turn of the 19th century into, like, around the year 1900... Oh my god, sorry, my kitty is getting really zoomy right now. But we have this history where there were Jews blamed for the outbreak of the Boer War, which was a war that the British Empire waged against the Boer states in South Africa. And there was this quotation that really stuck with me that was from a British socialist who claimed that the Jewish bankers wanted to construct an Anglo-Hebraic empire from the Cape to Egypt, which is wild. I think there's some really important element here that needs to be analyzed by the Jewish left, by the left in particular, because this idea of Jews as imperialists, sure, Zionism gives it some credence, but it has a really deep-rooted anti-Semitic undertone to it that I think needs to be taken seriously.
That's what Jeremy Corbyn got in trouble a few years ago when he wrote a foreword to a book by John Hobson,
yeah,
I believe. John Hobson. Who wasn't even particularly left-wing. He was a liberal.
He did inspire Lenin, though.
Yeah, well, Lenin was a liberal as well. No, cut. But you have similar sort of geographic... You always have this. I mean, there were Jewish communists that were purged from the Polish Communist Party after World War II for trying to set up a Jewish state in Lower Silesia. You had an Andina plan in Argentina, right, which grew the far right in Argentina. A lot of the, you know, the Nazis that moved there were quite strong, and especially after the capture of Eichmann, grew more in power. The thing I wanted to also mention is that you said this thing about her mother's parentage, which is interesting to me. I only read about this on the Forward magazine, which wrote an investigation saying that Claudia Sheinbaum's mother was born in Bulgaria and not in Mexico. And in the end, you know, I think it could be the case that you're running for the president of the country, people are calling you a foreigner, anti-Semitic stuff, and you want to make that case that your mother was born in Mexico. But these things really shouldn't matter. Right.
Yeah, no, like according to the law, she can definitely be president. And I don't remember if she was saying that. I don't remember exactly what it was, but they were definitely like using a lot of like anti-Semitic and xenophobic things against her. And what really, really kind of like a little bit disappointed me was, I will say that the core of the Jewish community in Mexico was against her and kind of like were not critical of how the opposition was using all these xenophobic and anti-Semitic tropes against her. And I was just like very shocked to see, like, I know that probably the Central Committee was doing something like backstage with anything that has to do with anti-Semitism, but I would have expected more outrage coming from members from the Jewish community. Now, I will say that doesn't mean that everyone within the Jewish community was supporting the person in the opposition, but I will say that a lot of them did. Interestingly, I think that a couple of important like Jewish members of the community will be working in her administration. For example, in the health department, there's going to be a doctor that has always been very important within the Jewish community. And there are, of course, exceptions. I would say like the most of the Jewish community in Mexico decided to support the opposition, mainly because they kind of like feel threatened in a certain way. But it's quite complicated because you do have other important members from the Jewish community that travel together with AMLO to the United States. It's kind of complicated to draw a line. I will say that most of the members of the Jewish community voted for the opposition, but there are very interesting exceptions. And they are very interesting, I wouldn't say groups, but people. And of course, there's a lot of rightful criticism to be made of what went wrong with this administration. I personally think that Claudia Sheinbaum will do things much better. I have a couple of problems on how she reacted to the feminist movement when she was the mayor of the city, and the way she kind of like did not open dialogue with some of the feminists that were protesting in the streets. So that's a big issue. She has to be able to separate herself from the current administration. Because at the end of the day, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, he wasn't doing anything for climate change. He doesn't believe in that. He has said things that are very, like, much against that. He is, in certain aspects, chauvinistic. And, well, of course, it's interesting to see that, like, in the kind of discourses and the narratives he makes and so on. But, of course, it's interesting that he has supported Claudia Sheinbaum now to become the president, right? So I think there are big challenges. There are big, big challenges for her. One of the main problems is that Andrés Manuel López Obrador came into power saying that the war against the narco was not the answer and that demilitarization should happen. And of course, he didn't do that. He continued with the militarization of the country. That's something that has always worried the left, the critical left, so to say. So that's going to be a challenge for Claudia Sheinbaum because violence is not getting better and militarization doesn't seem to be working. So that's going to be interesting to see. Like, there are a lot of critics from the left of Andrés Manuel López Obrador administration. That's not the critics you see most of the time. People from Hashomer Hatzair and so on, you do see those criticisms. From other people, you feel more like, oh, it's because they didn't build the airport or because they are going to take over our businesses or something like that. You do see that. But I guess it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, I really do appreciate having your perspective and criticism of the government in Mexico right now and the party, because a lot of the critiques that we might see on the mainstream Western media are really not in good faith. It's really important to be able to actually have like a left criticism of it all, because obviously like it's a government, it's almost, I mean, it's a dominant party. It's going to have some problematic elements, and it's important for us to wrestle with those. And I think it's really interesting what you brought up about UMLO's rejection of climate change. The lack of any action on that front is definitely really problematic. And I am very curious to see how Claudia's government is going to do differently, considering that, like, she is a scientist by profession, has actually contributed to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. And I imagine she's going to hopefully govern like it, and recognize that, like, maybe you shouldn't be putting so much resources into the state oil company and instead be taking some of that and investing it in clean energy. And I definitely hope we see that. And just before wrapping up, one of the biggest topics of conversation about the Mexican politics right now is around the judicial reform. And the judicial reform is enormous. And I would say, as someone that's from the United States and on the left, really, really interesting to be observing, because basically what it's doing is saying that every single judicial position, everyone that's a judge, is going to have to be elected, which, like, given the state of our Supreme Court in this country, I'm kind of jealous, because if we could actually vote on our Supreme Court, maybe we wouldn't have the right to an abortion being stripped from people and stuff like that. And it definitely is controversial, to say the least. You have people on the right and certain people, like liberals, saying that this is the end of Mexican democracy, and saying that the lack of having that judicial independence means that there's no more check on the executive's power and it's moving towards dictatorship. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your perspective on all that. It's okay if you're like, this isn't your expertise, but I was just wondering what you make of all this enormous shift and change within the Mexican constitutional system.
Yeah, that's definitely not my expertise. I think, like, there, it could be problematic for certain reasons, but yeah, if you take into account the example of the United States and what that has meant in terms of, like, very basic rights being stripped. But yeah, I completely understand. It's very, very, very problematic. It's true.
Whenever I hear judicial reform, I am still mentally scarred from the years and years and years and years of what's been happening in Poland and all the discourse surrounding that. That is still, it's going to be 10 years very soon as the whole crisis blew up. I hope that it is a step in the right direction in Mexico, and you don't see a lot of the similar problems that you have in the United States.
Yeah, I was just going to add, it's almost like Orwellian to see the American and Western discourse that's like, this is the end of Mexico's democracy, and this is like the headline, and then you read it and it's like, it's the end of Mexico's democracy because they're trying to democratize the judiciary. And, like, it just feels so Orwellian to say, like, it's anti-democratic to be promoting a democratic reform. And, like, I do understand that from a Montesquieu, like, three branches of government perspective, sure, you might see that, like, this is an erosion of checks and balances, but it just feels super doublespeak to say that this is anti-democratic to be actively expanding democracy. And of course, there are nuances to be unpacked there, but it just felt to me like we're seeing a break in American Mexican relations over this. We saw the ambassador literally say, like, this is bad for Mexico and this is going to harm the American Mexican relationship. And yet Mexico went forward with it. And we're seeing it as, like, a very clear impact and legacy of AMLO's government. And we're certainly going to be seeing some big changes and be very keen to keep our eyes on watching how Claudia governs in her term.
I wanted to add something interesting that has to do with the Latin American context in general.
Yeah, of course. Please do.
I must just say that when we talk about the left in Latin America, we have, like, two types of left. You have one left that is kind of represents the old left that has a lot of, like, chauvinism in it, that it's, like, against fighting climate change, more like the traditional old left. And then you have a left that is more progressive, that actually cares about climate change, that cares about, for example, LGBTQ+, way more open and understands more current challenges from not, like, the very recipes or something like that. And you do see people like that. You have, like, someone like Gabriel Boric in Chile. You have very interesting people, a lot of changes within the left. Hopefully, Claudia Sheinbaum will be able to represent this kind of, like, new left. Hopefully, that will be the case.
One of the reasons I'm so excited to chat with you is because, I mean, I have done a lot of research and analyzed the history of Latin America in the last 100 years. Frankly, Latin American politics are so inspiring compared to the rest of the world right now, because we don't see just the universal rise of right-wing and far-right politics. We are seeing, like, new wave of the pink tide with Gabriel Boric, as you mentioned, but also Xiomara Castro in Honduras, and even Bernardo Arevalo in Guatemala. We're seeing these anti-corruption at the very least, but, like, left-wing candidates that are taking office, and there's a lot of talk about Latin American integration. immigration, but you also have divides on the left that I think are really important to recognize. And as someone from the United States, we often see like the right wing spouting against Castro Chavismo, as they'll call it, of like this old left that they will define as authoritarian. And I was wondering if you could, just before we wrap up, just say a little bit about how that dynamic fits into this broader discussion about like different sections of the Latin American left. Just like the old left, the idea of like Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez, how those characters might fit into this broader conversation of divisions on the Latin American left.
I was teaching in a seminar in UCL about gender and the Cuban Revolution. And it is very clear that there was this very, very intrinsic macho culture that shaped the Cuban Revolution and that wanted to control the population. And gender became a very, very important component of that. And I think that is very different from the new left. Gender will be one of the main issues, right, to take into account. And at the end of the day, Fidel Castro and Maduro and so on were like the traditional machos and would kind of like promote a very patriarchal way of understanding the nation, the role of women and men in producing and in being loyal to the revolution and so on. And you do see that definitely is not the case with the new left. You do see that with certain leaders on the left. I will say that, for example, AMLO made very unfortunate comments about like, oh, narcos are narcos because their mothers did not educate them well, or all women deserve to go to heaven just because they are women. And very like chauvinistic comments that, of course, Claudia Sheinbaum is not going to be doing. So that's definitely something positive. Yeah. So luckily, I think it's going to be very different, but you do have this divide, as you explain better, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that sort of paternalism that leaks into even some like AMLO. I mean, AMLO is not an unproblematic character, but it's interesting how that manifests within his politics. And I do hope in a real way that Claudia Sheinbaum will kind of move out of his shadow, as a lot of certain media outlets are saying about her as being like kind of a continuation of AMLO's administration. And hopefully she will define her own politics in a way that breaks from these problematic elements of her past. And I mean, just to kind of reiterate, like these divides on the left do exist, but I also want to emphasize it's not like they're strict divides. I mean, Cuba has its issues for sure, but they also inaugurated their family code a couple years ago, which I think did confront these questions head on in a way that was really impactful. It's possible to see change along this as well, and it's really important to be able to have figures like this so that we can see the broader conversation along the broad American left, from all America's left, and hopefully move forward as a continent, as a set of continents, so that we can get the integration and abolish the imperialist tendencies from our corner of the Americas, so that we can move forward towards the better world that we would hope to live in. Thank you so much for joining us, Tamara. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, it has been my pleasure.
We are beautiful people.